History Program, tape number 80-5, 11 October 1980, Tarpon Springs, Florida. Okay, just to start things off, can you get your name and what you were in?
Nam. Okay, Ralph Dresser, in Vietnam, November of 65. That was 4 November 65 till, I think it was 4 November 66.
What was your job with the ranch?
Commander ranch hand during that time.
Okay. Now this is while it was still a detachment of the 309?
Well.
Or attached to the 309, I should say?
It was initially called the aerial spray flight, special aerial spray flight of the 309. That was up until August of 65. At that time, we got a set of orders that assigned us to the, I think it was the 14th Air Commando Wing, the one in the Trang, as I remember. And they came back the next week and says, no, cancel that. And then I got another set of orders. Seems like it was in September or October that made us the 12th Air Commando Squad. And because I was a squadron commander for about 2 months there, and then Dennis came in, Dave Dennis, came in and took over, and I rotated back, and then the outfit moved on up to Benoit.
So all the time you were there was at Tonsonute?
All the time I was there was at Tonsonute. We planned the move and did some of the early coordination with the Benoit people and so on. That coordination was, you know, how many people you got and what requirements do you have to support the airplanes, how many, like vehicles, special type vehicles, and we had a big issue about where to park them and the airplane parking and our loading requirements, the logistics and maintenance aspects of the operation. We wanted to take as much advantage as we could to set up a permanent hydrant system up there that we could use the different chemical agents that we had. I can't precisely remember, but when we used orange, we couldn't follow it with purple, or we couldn't follow that with white, but you could put blue it was. Blue and white and orange that we were using. And there was some combination that you had to run some other chemical through the pump area there in order to keep them contaminating or affecting the chemical itself. So we spent a lot of time with the Benoit people trying to, and we designed the system that you guys ended up with up there at Benoit, to have the tanks and the different pipe and just use valves and so on, so that we didn't have to worry about that business. And a lot of time in convincing the Benoit people of the special needs that we had as far as the operation, the numbers of emergency landings that we had and averaged, and battle damage and taxiing the mode of our operation, early morning type operation, the damage that they could expect in the immediate community, which at that time was a significant thing because we hadn't been allowed to spray in Benoit province too much. And there was, remember the little, out on the west end of that little hill out there that had the pagoda and all that?
Yeah.
We told them, you know, that was going to suffer some damage and
fumes.
As it at Tonsonute, our area there on Charlie Road, for about at least a quarter of a mile up toward the terminal, the prevailing winds being out of the south, the fumes off of the herbicide over the years have just denuded all those trees in front of the terminal and so on.
Yeah, I remember seeing that when I first got there.
And we trying to convince them that was going to happen at Benoit, and that's all that we felt the problem was going to be, was just denuding the trees and not have any problem to the people. So yeah, I finished out at Tonsonute and came home, and Dennis took over for, oh, I guess it was about a month after I left, and then they all went up to Benoit as a prime base of operation. We had, starting in, seems like it was December or January, and don't pin me to these dates too close, that we started a TDY operation out of Da Nang. And we kept two or three birds up there in my state.
Of 66.
This was in December of 65 or January of 66.
Okay.
I've checked some of the other guys because I don't remember it that much. We started going up there and operating out of Da Nang because logistically you couldn't get to those targets up there. And we had a couple of tanks, Herbie tanks we put on the ground and kept guys up. We tried several different modes of rotating guys from Saigon up there. A few guys decided they liked Da Nang better anyway. They were able to live off base then. And what'd they call that? The Nav House downtown in Da Nang. And anyway, as long as they could live off base, it was pretty pleasant assignment up there. And some guys decided they'd just soon stay, but we had a combination. Some guys that would rotate. To kind of keep my finger on things, I tried to get up there about 1 week out of every three and stay a week and fly to see what was going on. And the targets that we went up there for at the time were the classified targets over in Laos. And some DMZ targets that they wanted us to get into. And we also had a couple of two flights we put into North Vietnam.
Some of the guys have talked about insignia changing. Were you using different insignia on the airplanes at that time?
Sure. The farm gate rules said that anytime we want a crop target, that we had to have Vietnamese markings on board. And we also had to have a VNAF observer on board to supposedly, it was a facade that they were directing or responsible, or the operation was under their purview, the crop. The guy that, in fact, was on board, we had about four or five little Vietnamese two or three stripers that would ride in the back, tough little guys, we admired them all. They would ride in the back and they would kind of augment the flight engineer there or throwing smoke out or, you know, doing one thing or another, but just to be there.
But hardly in charge.
No, they weren't in charge. Most of them spoke a little English. That's where the ranch guys got carried away about having a Buddha, wearing a little Buddha. I still got mine. I've got it in my flying suit tonight. And when a guy would get into the ranch, they'd go down and buy him a Buddha and ask him to wear it, you know, so they felt like that was going to help them out a little bit. And we weren't going to turn down any bets on Buddha business,
anything.
So anything to help out. So we would wear the Buddhas for them. But
when you went, you said mentioned Laos and North Vietnam, what insignia did you use?
We always used American insignia. On the Laos things, and we used American in the two runs at North.
So it was only crop that you used?
Only on crop in South Vietnam that we used. And we had them listed with Zeus fasteners, you know, you go up and they weren't really Zeus, they were little butterfly-like fasteners, but you had the American insignia on there and you put the Vietnamese, it was the same shape, and you just turned the four screws on it and that's what stuck it on.
How many aircraft did you have in this period?
Well, when I got there, the ranch had four airplanes. And the group I came over with, we had nine people that came over, six pilots and three navs. And we brought three airplanes over with us.
Well, you ferried over.
Yeah, we ferried.
Lovely.
We ferried spray birds over from from Hobart.
That must have been a fun haul.
Yeah, it was. It was. It was 72 hours plus of flying time. At that time, we got our initial training like everybody else down at Hobart, and then they sent us up to Langley for 4 to 6 weeks.
Did you actually do any spraying up at Langley?
Yeah, we did. They had the old birds up at the time that had the steering knob on the windshield here. And we went up and flew for a couple of weeks on the river out west of Langley there, just using water, spraying
the
water. And kind of getting the spray down, and then the formation bit down at low level. And then we started working on the area that was just off the base. They called it the plum tree area, and that's where the plum tree turn terminology got started.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a little area. It's just a bunch of swamps and grove, like mangrove type swamps right off the about 2 or 3 miles off of Langley, and we'd get out there and make our passes and do a turn on either end, regular crop duster type of pattern, and they played the game about pulling engines and, different emergencies while you're on target. All in all, it was pretty good training. And while we were there, the base itself was still an active insecticide, and we sprayed Langley with insecticide one or two mornings while we were there. With the IP would jump in the left seat and the student would go along and fly the right seat for him. And then we had another Navy base that we went down to, can't remember the name, Norfolk Navy facility. And we went over there and sported some insecticide mosquito control for those people. So yeah, then we went back to Hobart. And we spent a week or so back there, and our efforts were directed towards getting these three airplanes. We didn't know this until about halfway through our training at Langley that we were going to take some birds back. So we went back to Hobart, and the problem was we had the dump valve in the tanks, and to get that so that it would seal and not leak the avgas that we had. They modified the airplanes. They had a little 55-gallon drum in the back with a Sears and Roebuck hand pump on it and hoses that led up, and you could turn 3 turns an hour to the right engines and 4 turns an hour to the left engine, to replenish the oil in those R2800s.
Yeah.
But it was the spray tank, the new tanks that we had, and getting them to seal and hold up the avgas is what we were delayed there with. And they finally got all three birds ready, and in that time we'd had some opportunity to think about heavyweight takeoffs, which nobody had ever made before in our group, a heavyweight for that airplane. It seemed like we were taking off at around 62,000 or something is what we were going to do.
A little bit over the TO growth.
Yeah, the TO was like 58, I think.
It might even been lower than that, I think about
56. 52 or 56. It seems like we were going out of there at about 60, and you say, well, why do that? Well, what we wanted to do was to, if we had to have a problem, we wanted to have it in the States and not over the Pacific.
Right.
And what we were going to do is fly nonstop from Hobart to McClellan, which was our jumping off point. We had to go under the Second Air Delivery Group once we got to McClellan. So we're going to wait and get all airplanes ready to go at the same time, and everything finally came up to standard, and we loaded everybody up, and first airplane, we all three taxied out at the same time, and we weren't going to make formation takeoff, of course, at that heavy weight. So the first guy was going to get off, and that was myself. And I was gonna call back and tell him what it was like.
Yeah, I made it.
Give him a little briefing. Yeah, we made it.
Guess what? It works.
And we did that. We divided up our crews. We had, we had nine pilots. I'm sorry, I thought it was six pilots. We had nine pilots, and we had two navigators from there. Pete Spivey was one, and Paul Clanton was another. And let's see, we had another one, Fred, I can't think of his name right offhand. But anyway, Paul Clanton and I'll think of his name later, Jim McCrady, no, that's not important. We took off and flew out and did cruise control techniques to learn the procedures for the cruise of the airplane and all that, which we had very little of, you know, just a little nav training there at Hobart. And the oil consumption was very important to us, to learn to rate that oil consumption. So we had six crew chiefs with us, that's what it was, six flight engineers, and they were all going to be in the ranch too. Good bunch of troops. And we all started out, and we got out in West Texas someplace, and one of the airplanes had a problem, so he diverted up to Dias, had an engine cutting out on him or something like that. He diverted into Dias and spent a couple hours on the ground. I guess he changed some plugs or something, and he got off the ground. Anyway, all ended up at McClellan that night. And, you know, a lot of war stories about that, and sat down and computed out our long-range type things and thought we'd make it. And then we got all the briefings by Second Aircraft Delivery Group. They weren't satisfied that we only had three navigators. We had to augment the navigators, so they went over, and at that time they had a 124 outfit somewhere around there, and they grabbed a couple of navigators off of that and put them on board. And there really wasn't much a navigator could do, you know, because the whole heading and airspeed and altitude. And one airplane, all we had, and that was my airplane, all we had was a radio compass. And another one we had a Loran set on, and the third one we had, I think we had a sextant capability on it. So we were going to fly a loose formation. And some reason the regs of the Second Air Delivery Group wouldn't let us do that at that altitude. So we fiddled it around and we decided, well, first airplane will take off 5 minutes late, and the second airplane on time, and the third airplane 5 minutes early, and we'll be somewhere in the near vicinity of Sky, which was about right. And so we departed, and it took us 19 and a half hours to get to Hickam. Went from Hickam to Midway to Wake or Guam, I don't remember which one was next, and then Guam, and then Clark, and spent the night at Clark, and two nights at Clark, kind of getting our time clocks turned back around, and then we went on in to Vietnam the next day. And, that brought us up to seven airplanes. By the time I left in November of 66, we had 12 airplanes. And I guess later it went up 25 or 30. I don't know what the other numbers are.
Had you lost any planes while you were there?
Yeah. We lost one up in the Pineapple Forest. Paul Clanton and Steve Eigner and Junior Winstead were operating out of Da Nang one morning. And Paul was the IP. Both pilots were real short stature, small kind of guys. Paul was his first lieutenant, one of our IPs, and they took a hit in the right engine, in the prop, and they lost the ability to feather the prop, and Paul held the airplane level, but it turned some 180 to 270 degrees, and Paul saw he wasn't going to be able to hold it wings level and keep it from stalling. And so he saw a little clearing right ahead of him, and he pulled a good engine back and crash-landed it straight ahead, and tore at the right part of the fuselage pretty badly, and the airplane caught on fire, and Steve Eigner and Junior couldn't get Paul out of the cockpit. They had to go outside and pull him out through the open side of the fuselage that had been broken open, and Paul was in pretty bad shape, and lo and behold, they had crash-landed right at the foot of a base camp, and our other bird, I wasn't in that flight, I was down at Saigon at the time, but our other bird stayed with them and started putting out mayday calls. And the fighters expended all their ammo, and the guys on the ground were about to use up all their ammo or what they had. And as luck had it, there were 7 Marine helicopters. They weren't too far from Chulai, the Marine base. 7 helicopters from Chulai were coming over after a fruitless search and destroy mission, and they were all loaded for bear and all hacked off. So they heard the mayday call, and they just went right in the big middle of all this shooting match going on down there, and landed and jumped out like a John Wayne movie, you know, and grabbed these 3 guys off the ground, put them in the helicopter. They were on the ground, I think, less than 5 minutes, as I recall. Just as, you know, a beautiful stroke of fate. And they took them over to Chulai in the hospital, and they had to finally take Paul down to Cameron, and then they air-evac him back to the States out of there. So that was the one airplane that we lost. That was the only one I can recall right offhand. We lost a couple just after I left. We had our first fatality. What? Honey, you just sit back. I'm about to tell him about that. I knew you were over there in earshot. We had Tom Davies was our first fatality to hostile fire. To that time, I guess, 6-year life at the ranch, 5 or 6-year life. And Tom took a round right here, flying in the seat, and just was dead right then. And then right after the first of the year in 66, Roy Kubley and five or six others were over in Laos, and they took fire and rolled in and went in. And then about a month later, one of the new guys, the one I arrived there, he'd been there about 2 months. He was flying with a bunch, and they tried to fly up a ridge, as I understand it, up near somewhere in the Central Highlands, and snapped the airplane. That was Pilot Air, I suspect. They never were able to, you know, look over the airplane to determine, but it sounded to me like he just stalled the airplane and snapped it. I guess that's about all the recall I've got on those losses. So.
We're talking about hostile fire. What would you guess was about the frequency of hits on spray missions at this time?
We did a little thought and study about that, and we figured we were getting about 1 hit for every 10 rounds. Most of, probably, in my judgment, 90% of the stuff we were taking broadly across the country was small arms type stuff. There were a few target areas, what we call a west area out west of Saigon, and down in the Mekong, a couple of areas on the river, several areas in Laos where we got 50 caliber stuff pretty bad. You know, that was the predominance of fire we took. But most of our target areas, you got small arm, handheld, or automatic weapon fire. And I think, as I recall at that point, we figured about 1 out of 10, judging on what you could hear and the number of hits you had. And we were averaging, I had to brief General Momar about that time, and the numbers that I seemed to be using were somewhere between 50 and 60 hits per bird per month. I had it down on a card precisely by month, and I think the lowest month, as I remember, was around 40, and the highest was up in a 65 or 70, because we had some missions that you'd had 30 or 40 holes in an airplane, and not very many of those. usually your hits would be somewhere between 1 and maybe 5 or 6.
But, did you have armor boxes for the flight mechs
this
time?
Mm-hmm.
That was already there.
We didn't have the super collars. We had the armor box and the back, and we had the...
The regular flight vest, not the ceramics.
We had the regular flight vest and not the ceramics. A lot of guys had the groin protectors and different guys. I remember Vern Euler had a, looked like a German steel helmet that he wore in the back with ear things down on it. And
one of those old World War II flak
Looked like
helmet.
An old flak helmet.
Yeah,
that's what
yeah.
it was. Yeah, and he had that. And, you know, we, any gang of guy wanted to try, that was up to him. We didn't limit imagination on that. The guys were looking forward to that thing with a collar on it if it didn't impede you there. And but most of the stuff we had was just that old zip-up thing that had the lace on the sides. And some guys would sit on another one, and then the parachute in the back was considered armor plating too, and then a little bit of that stuff in the seat and that little foam-like thing down there. And I think there was a nylon curtain that was hung up in front of the instrument panel someplace, and then that little quarter-inch stuff that was a standard underneath the floor. But we took out everything we thought we could, the heaters and everything else, to cut down on the shrapnel potential. We didn't, none of the special armor that we had. We didn't have jets either then, you see. We just had the recips. You know, a funny thing talking about recips, they came out, early 66, when some of the bureaucrats were really thinking of really cranking up the defoliation program with regard to war zone C and D. And they knew it was going to be a big requirement of numbers of airplanes. They could see this 25 airplane squadron down the road, and the airlift guys were complaining because the 123 was filling a need there that the 130s couldn't get into some fields, 3,000 foot or less they wouldn't go into. And the 123 could get down to 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet. So they asked us to consider what other airplane we would find useful for the spring mission. And we said, what are our choices? And they said, well, how about the P-2V or the B-17? Well, obviously big loads, straight and level, long distances, and no maneuverability considerations, nothing like that. And we discarded those out of hand for the various reasons, you know, that we couldn't, under that one mission of those two target areas, war zone C and D might be all right, but certainly none of the other targets, and not even really very good for those. So that kind of got put on the back burner.
You mentioned, when we were talking about Leos and that, you mentioned one North Vietnam.
Yeah.
Did you take much fire out of there or any heavier
Lost
fire?
Lost an airplane up there. That's what I was trying to think of. It wasn't our airplane, though. We took two airplanes and went through the Bang Karai Pass. And
through the what?
The Bang Karai Pass.
Oh, okay.
And the fighter guys were, you know, they were, the planners didn't think that we could get there. We said, well, we think we can if we can do it our way. And our way is, one, surprise, two, not having a big air armada up there to alert them that something's coming off. They asked what we wanted. We said B-57s, two of them, hold high and dry outside. We ziggy in, turn around, and as we start to come back out, because they know that we're there, then come in and pre-strike, or post-strike, if you will.
Half-strike,
and get their attention while we scoot on out. And our birds got in all right, and the B-57s came in to do their thing, and one of them got shot out. And our guys ended up acting as low cap while the other B-57 was high cap to get the chopper in to pick the two guys up, and they got out all right.